Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
Joining us in center ring today, we have attorney Lyle Solomon. Lyle started his career in criminal justice and then morphed into debt consolidation. He is currently with the Oakview Law Group, and that is what he does for them. But what he's going to do for us today in regards to divorce is help straighten out our finances, maybe not let us get into as much hot water as we can potentially get into when our finances are in flux. And isn't divorce all made up of money? Yes, there are the kids, who of course cost money, but that is what divorce is. It's sorting out the finances, sorting out the money so that everybody can leave independent of each other and deal with their own finances. So I really appreciate that you've joined us today, Lyle. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judith. Joy to be with you.
Well, let's start with the settlement agreement. Everything leads up to the settlement agreement. And one of the things people are really worried about when we write settlement agreements is if there is significant debt and spouses have kind of swapped who's paying what, now they're getting divorced. And in the debt section of the settlement agreement, there's quite a lot of language that talks about each spouse paying the debt listed under their names. But unfortunately, Lyle, the credit card companies don't know what they're doing for the settlement agreement. So what happens when one spouse, greatest fear of another spouse, what happens when one spouse is approached by a collector to pay the other spouse's debt?
Well, let me say what happens, tell you what happens in all practicality. First off, if this is not as amicable as you would like it to be, what I face is if I approach one spouse, say the ex-husband, and he says, oh, it's her debt. And if he's not happy with her at that moment, I get every piece of information from him that I might ever want to know, especially about finances, where she's working, what assets she has that she got out of the divorce. And it's, I mean, heaven help the person whose ex is not happy with them when a process server or a debt collector comes to them, because they're more than happy to share all the information there is. And there's one big reason for that. Even if they are happy with the ex, even if it has been amicable, and part of it is they don't want to be responsible. They want, you know, if in the settlement agreement we said wife is going to be responsible for all of these debts, and I come to husband and he says, but I'm not responsible, he's more than happy to tell me everything I need to know to go after wife, because she's now got the debt.
And are you inferring that she's not paying the debt?
And that is the circumstance that I'm talking about.
Okay.
Is if we're not being paid, if things have got into arrears, that's when I get contacted about these things. And so when a debt collector comes, and you know, husband's first hope is you're not going to come after me because I've just told you that she took the debt on. She took that responsibility. The caveat to that, you know, and the thing that I hope that debt collectors are telling that husband, the thing that I hope they are telling him is, you're still on the hook as far as that credit card company is concerned until we actually see a marital settlement agreement with a court order that specifies these debts are now the responsibility, solely the responsibility of one party or the other.
Okay, well, that's where I was going with this, because in the settlement agreements, it is a debt is assigned to each individual. So if when you go to see the husband about the wife's debt and he pulls out the marital settlement agreement and the judge has already signed it, what does that do then to you as a debt collector?
Well, unfortunately for, it does not stop the debt collector from trying to go forward. It usually ends up that the debt collector will continue to try collecting from both parties, despite that assignment, because we're talking as the debt collector is looking strictly at contract law. They're not looking at family law. They're looking at contract law. And because your credit card agreement is a contract, and that contract usually has a non-assignment clause in it, which says, this is a joint debt and it cannot be assigned without the agreement of the creditor.
Okay, so wait a minute. A couple is married and the wife takes out a credit card in her own name.
Right.
Owes money on it and right. She takes that debt with her.
Then
nobody can go after the husband, right? If it's just her name on that debt. Or am I wrong?
Judgment collection law says that if the husband, if they were husband and wife during the time that the debt was incurred, he may be added to the judgment. At the time that he may be. And that's up to that's a motion that the creditor has to make to a civil judge and has to give notice to the couple. And they may, if they come in and they say this was entirely hers, yes, it was incurred during marriage, but his name was never on the account. I can see judges saying, you're right, it stays with her alone. But, that's a case-by-case thing. And I've seen judges simply say, you were married during the time of it. We're a community property state. It goes to both of you. The judge, we can add the spouse to the judgment once a judgment is received.
Are you talking about a judgment from the collection company?
Yeah, once the collection company has a judgment against, say, in this instance, you're talking the wife's card. If the collection company gets a judgment against wife and then finds out that they were married during the time of the existence of that card, they can make a motion to add the husband. Now, if they're already divorced by that stage, as a practical matter, the most collection companies, I don't think, are going to go after try and add husband because they're now divorced.
That's a relief to people listening. That's a big relief.
Well, and it can get messy. As we've discussed, finances can get very messy. And even, like you say, the agreement is what the parties want to live by and what the parties negotiate and so forth. But they, it may be up to a civil judge to decide how that initial contract with the creditor is interpreted, even relating it to the marital settlement agreement and what order comes out of the family court.
Okay. Now let's look at a topsy-turvy situation that really does happen, and that is husband makes more money than wife. They're getting divorced. Husband wants to help wife out and assumes some of her debt, and it's listed in the settlement agreement as part of the settlement. Then something happens to husband, the pandemic, job lost. Now he can't be responsible for what he assumed in the marital settlement agreement. Debt collection company goes to wife because they don't know, right? Wife pulls out the settlement agreement. But wait a minute. Yes, I agree. That was my debt. But he, in the settlement agreement, and look, the judge signed it, said he would take it off my back. They don't care, do they?
No, no. I see this all the time, that the collection agency or the original creditor, whichever it is, trying to enforce that, is going to fall back to the original contract. Who were the parties to the original contract, the original agreement? And again, they're going to, the big thing they're going to say is, if you assigned it to somebody, we, the creditor, had to be a party to that assignment. Yes, we'll accept payment from anybody. that's just a fact there, that the creditor will accept payment from anybody on your account. Now, I said that, and then I just realized that I've dealt with banks and credit unions that won't, as that may not. I've had an occasion where, a stranger can't deposit into your account, but making a payment on a consumer debt is one of those things where, if it's properly routed, I have not seen the creditor have a problem with who that payment's coming from. They're willing to accept it.
Okay. Innocent spouse relief. What is that? It has such a nice ring to it, doesn't it?
It does. And again, it's my experience with it is very limited. But the little bit I have seen of it is where you have one spouse acting in a manner that the other spouse is totally ignorant of.
And that in large measure comes with tax returns, signing off on tax returns without reading. Honey, just sign.
Exactly. Where I think of, when you say innocent spouse relief, I immediately go to, there is some kind of fraud, whether it be tax or, in the arena of taxes or in some other manner, that the innocent spouse is somehow caught up in because they were married at the time. And the unfortunate thing is, in civil law, that's called an affirmative defense, which means it's upon the innocent spouse to come and put forth evidence of that innocence. And in some cases, it's very easy. Things were signed when they weren't there, dated, at a time when the spouse wasn't there.
I know. Isn't it shocking that one spouse will sign, and I actually mean this, one spouse will actually sign the other spouse's name, whether it's on an IRS, a tax return, or on a refinance of a mortgage, and the person whose name was forged is in shock. How could this transaction happen without me signing it? Well, isn't that easy enough to figure out? A handwriting analysis maybe will do the trick.
Do you know what a handwriting expert charges these days?
More than $5? No, how much?
Oh, yes. And in fact, on that point, I'm probably going to go spend a good part of a day next week or the week after with a handwriting specialist in a case out of Santa Clara County that is large enough numbers that it warrants having this expert and spending most of a day with him to go through documents, and specifically one document that, one side claims is a forgery, and it's very material to the case. So, I have no doubt that in most of these situations with the spouse, where one spouse is claiming innocence, that the numbers are large enough to merit that. But at the same time, if the innocent spouse is usually the one that doesn't have any anything to be able to fight with anyway. So it's a hard circumstance.
What words of wisdom can you give people when they're dividing up debt in a settlement for a divorce and they're trading off who's paying what? What can they do to assure that they go forward in a clean manner, paying off the debt?
The first thing that I would say is be honest with each other about it. And I mean beyond just, hey, I took on this debt, I took on that. Be honest about the amount. Be honest about what is actually there. And part of that honesty then, be real, be realistic. I mean, we see guys all the time, we see parties all the time, whether it be the wife or the husband, one of them wants to be the white knight, to be, you know, the hero here. And I'll take on all the debt. Well, you have to be realistic as to your ability, the ability to do that. If one party has got a law degree or an MBA, you know, some advanced degree, and the other party doesn't even have a bachelor's degree, most of the time that indicates a great discrepancy in earning potential. And so, the one who has the lesser earning capacity or potential should be realistic about what they're willing to take on and what they're going to offer to take on. And that goes both ways, though, too. I unfortunately have seen friends get near my age and decide that, I'm tired of this life, and file for divorce. The other party saying, oh, but you've been making a great living. Yeah, but I'm ready to retire. And my retirement income is going to be very, very different than what my income has been prior to, while working full time. Mm-hmm. So it's be realistic about it and be honest with each other about what the expectations can be and should be.
Okay. Under the umbrella term of be realistic.
Of course.
There are cases that we've all seen in which one spouse knows there's debt, but doesn't have a clue the massive extent of the debt until the disclosure forms are completed and exchanged. And then the unknowing spouse just about faints.
Right.
Debt's so heavy that spousal and child support, how are they going to get paid? Because even if you can attempt to make the minimum payment on 20 stores, I've seen this, I've written this, that takes up all your money if you're of an average earning situation, in an average earning situation. So I've asked if bankruptcy ever crosses their minds. Is that the only option? How do you, if you had to counsel somebody that's overwhelmed with with credit card debt, store debt, they're getting divorced, they have kids, there's spousal and child support, the roof is caving in. What do you do?
Well, bankruptcy clearly is a valid option. The other part of it, though, is that there are companies out there, such as Oakview Law Group, that will, for a percentage of money saved, go and work with you and work with your credit, work with these individuals and approach the creditors and try and work out either a smaller payment plan or negotiate a payoff at a lower amount.
Okay.
The sad fact is, though, that majority of creditors do not do those kind of negotiations until you're behind, until you have missed two or three of those minimum payments. And they're in a position where they could now go and file a lawsuit and go and get a judgment to try and find a way to start collecting on it. So it's, you know, I mean, those are options. In that specific situation with that much debt, I know that a lot of people find that bankruptcy may be their best solution. And I just always caution people that if they're going to go, that's what they choose to pursue, you know, the path they choose to go down, that they gain as much knowledge about it as they can first, so that they know all of the ramifications. Now, the one plus, or maybe a plus on that, is for the other spouse, is bankruptcy does not discharge spousal support or child support obligations.
Right. And I know you're not a divorce attorney, but you must have, hopefully you've seen this in your work, and that is, there are these kids. I mean, in California, child support trumps spousal support. The kids have to be taken care of first. Hopefully, the spouse receiving spousal support can get a job. But be that as it may, when child support is considered, all those debts, and this is something very important for people to know, all those debts are not considered and factored into the calculations, at least in California, for child support. So you now have a child support number based on what you earn and a couple other deductibles. And then you have this massive debt that even if you pay minimum, it eats up more than you even earn. What happens then?
Well, one thing that can happen, and I don't ever advise people to just casually let a judgment be entered against them, but you bring up a good point, and that is that when, say, this spouse then defaults on all those accounts, and they get assigned to a collection agency, or the creditor themselves comes after them, and they, you know, they can't defend it in court. They don't have a legal defense, and now the creditor has a judgment, and the creditor wants to collect on that judgment. Well, the first thing that a creditor, or that I have in the past looked at with creditors when trying to collect on a judgment, is our debtor employed? Where are they employed? And let's get a writ from the court and send out a garnishment of wages. And wages can be garnished at up to 25% of your wages earned. Well, the first thing, if that happens, the debtor receives notice that there's a wage garnishment out there, and they are told, or they have the option then of filing what's called a claim of exemption. And a claim of exemption says, my wages should be exempt from collection because, and, you know, I've seen them, and people say, well, I have this car payment, and I have this credit card payment, and I have this private school payment, and I have, you know, I owe my mother money, and they put all these things down. Well, the statute doesn't care that you have another car payment or that your child goes to private school even. But if you have court-ordered spousal support and child support those two items are, you know, are bases for a court to grant a claim of exemption.
Oh.
And I've had instance, I had instance years ago where I had a man who had a very prestigious, high-paying job, and he owed my client quite a bit of money. And I sent out the wage garnishment, and I got it back, and we collected $90 a month for several years from this man. And the reason, you know, and it wasn't what was available, but we sat behind his child support obligations. And so we were, you know, we with a couple of other creditors, I don't know exactly how many there were, but I know we weren't the only one, sat there getting, you know, $90 a month, which didn't even cover the costs and interest accruing on a monthly basis on this debt. But we could not by law collect any more from him because child support was there. And, you know, believe me, my client knew when those children were going to age out and was, you know, would remind me every once in a while, you know, when one of them did.
Mm-hmm.
So that we could hopefully get in there before somebody else and get a little more money.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
But in the meantime, while those child support orders weren't in place, and you already know that, you know, they're not something that have to be renewed. They are based on certain criteria, and they go until, you know, what is it now, age 19?
18 or 19, but graduated from high school is the key.
Right. Right. So, you know, they don't, you know, if you start going out, if, you know, I have heard of and actually known a couple of people that, you know, had full 14, 15 years of that, of paying child support because of when the divorce occurred.
Right.
So that is a tool that that the debtor can use. And it's a form, it's a simple form, but there are time limits and they have to use it. And that's one of the things that I encourage people when they say, oh, you know, I used to get calls from different people about, hey, I owe on this credit card and they just filed a lawsuit against me. What do I do? And while I was representing banks and credit card companies, I had to say to them, well, you know, you need to call somebody else. I can't really do that. But I would tell them every county in the state of California is supposed to has either for that county or for neighboring counties may share a public law library. And every public law library is supposed to have a self-help service.
I see where you're going with this.
And that is usually manned by attorneys that are volunteering and can help people. And so I advise people all the time, and judges advise people all the time that show up and say, hey, I don't know what I'm doing, but I can't afford an attorney, or I haven't found an attorney who will help me. I've watched judges have their bailiffs, clerks, whoever in the courtroom hand out the paper, the information on where legal self-help is available at either in the courthouse or at the public law library.
That's really good.
And, you know, while the attorneys volunteering there may not have specific expertise in the area of either family law or consumer debt, they do have, you know, they have some knowledge of it. And if they're in the law library, the librarian
they can figure out how to look things up, right?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. And the law librarian is an excellent resource for that. You know, I've dealt with law librarians in my area, some that I just cherish as a resource, because they knew, you know, they didn't always know the answer to the question, but they knew where to find the answer and how to point, you know, me or whoever else was asking the question in the right direction and get them to a place where they could help themselves.
This is excellent information for people. Now, clarify for me, please.
Uh-oh.
Is there still debtor's prison?
No. That's the short answer. There is no debtor's prison.
Okay.
Now, I've had people feel like they were in prison when their wages were getting garnished, when they weren't. I had a woman show up at a hearing years ago wanting to have her wages exempted from collection. And her reasoning was she had two new cars that she was paying for. Also, and, you know, the judge just, you know, and my argument was my judgment predated those new cars.
Don't you just love people innocently? Well, but I have two new cars to pay for. Although I'm in massive debt, I have two new cars to pay for.
Well, the reason I remember this is because the judge leaned over the bench and looked at this woman and said, I suggest you go find a second job. And, you know, the lady was mortified that she, you know, that she wasn't going to get some kind of relief. And the judge just said, you know, Mr. Solomon's correct. I can see the paperwork here. The judgment predates your new cars, and it's a legal obligation. And, you know, I have no statutory authority to relieve you of it. So maybe you need to go find a second job.
I love that, Lyle. That's precious. I want to talk about bankruptcy a second. I mean, people do really amaze me. The innocence with which they say things that kind of make no sense, but they believe it and it's important and they say it. And I just have to smile sometimes. That's a good story. But I want to talk about bankruptcy a second, because I want to make sure people are clear about this as an option. First of all, it is my view, and you can tell me what your experience is, bankruptcy is a really big decision. It's emotional. It carries shame with it. Sometimes religiously, people are not allowed to do that, because in some religions, financial malfeasance is a sin. You have to be clean in the way you approach life and be responsible with how you earn money and spend money and raise a family. But for personal bankruptcy, what is that? 713, all these numbers are attached to bankruptcy. What is this bankruptcy for personal?
Okay, for an individual or a couple, the two options are either a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13.
Okay.
Those are two very different animals. A Chapter 7 ultimately results in a discharge of a portion, if not all, of the debt brought into the bankruptcy, if the individuals qualify. A 13 is a reorganization plan, and it does not result in discharge. It is actually telling the court telling the creditors that they will accept so much a month for a period of time. The maximum time, at least last time I checked, for a Chapter 13 plan was 5 years. So that means for 5 years in Chapter 13, individuals are paying a bankruptcy trustee, paying money to them And that trustee is then making the payments for the individual to creditors as approved by the court in the proposed repayment plan. And the thing that I might note about that is there are items that may be left out of a Chapter 13 plan. The biggest item, the most common, is a mortgage, and is that, you know, a person filing Chapter 13 bankruptcy says, "I don't want to include the mortgage. I can afford to pay the mortgage as it sits if these other debts are all reorganized and, you know, and given smaller payments." That is all subject, though, to approval by the bankruptcy judge. And like I say, this is very different from a 7, because a Chapter 7, an individual walks in and says, "I have more debt than I have assets." The trustee takes a look at what the person has, and the most common finding is called no assets. And when a bankruptcy trustee makes the finding of no assets, then it results in a discharge of all of the debts listed in the bankruptcy.
Is that what you meant by if they qualify for a 7, no Yes. assets? Is that one of the qualifications?
Well, even if they have assets, they can still qualify for a 7, but it's not as cut and dry. In bankruptcy, when an individual files a Chapter 7, there are exemptions, items that they get to keep regardless. There's an exemption of so much on a house. So up to a certain amount of any house is still exempted. So if your house is underwater, but you want to keep it, that's not going to be seen as an asset. An asset has to be something that actually has value to it. And, I've sat through numerous trustees hearings and going through assets with individuals as to what they have and don't have. And so that the trustee can make a determination of whether they're assets or not. And 90 to 95% of them that I've seen with individuals have resulted in a finding of no assets, meaning that there is nothing beyond nothing of value beyond the exemption values that are allowed by bankruptcy law. The one of the exceptions I saw to that was a man, and he actually happened to be an attorney who showed up filing bankruptcy, and the trustee had him up there the longest I've ever seen one of those hearings go, I think, because he started going through the assets that he had listed. And, you know, well, here's this original painting. Are you sure that your valuation here is correct, sir? Well, yeah, I did. When I got it, it was only worth this. Well, sir, I've done a little research. You know, these bankruptcy trustees are charged with doing that, doing research on
assets. They're little financial detectives.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and the man had half a dozen paintings that he had listed at practically no value that were quite valuable. And, you know, in another one of those exceptions that I sat in, the man had 3 classic cars that he had listed as, you know, as no value because they weren't currently operating. Well, but there were pictures of them at car shows. They were not the rusted out, you know, beater that's sitting in the barn. They were classic cars stored in climate controlled
oh my
garages, and that had won awards at car shows. They had value. And so that's always a caveat, to individuals thinking about bankruptcy.
Be honest about it, because you're going to get caught, right?
Well,
It's easy to get caught.
And it's easier today than it ever has been.
Because of digital and the way the research is done.
Digital and social, et cetera. And something for people to consider when talking about bankruptcy also, I read an article not too long ago where somebody was saying, well, you know, I'll just transfer everything into my mother's name or whatever. And in fact, I had a good friend approach me about that years ago. And he's, you know, he thought he was facing a situation where he was going to be attacked financially. And he thought bankruptcy, you know, might be a good idea. And his first thing was that he had several bare lots of real estate, and he was going to transfer them into his mother's name. And I had to remind him that bankruptcy court has a minimum of a 6-month look back. And what that means is from the date of your filing bankruptcy, the court can and will look back 6 months in time to see what kind of transfers, sales, exchanges, or, you know, any other type of transaction that you've had involving assets. If, you know, 5 months before you file bankruptcy, you transferred all of your real property into your mother's name, they're going to look back and find that. And the bankruptcy court is then going to call that a sham transfer and credit those or judge those assets to be attributable to that individual. The other problem with that for an individual is, as they say in bankruptcy, as they warn us in bankruptcy court when I've gone in, they have big signs. Fraud in a bankruptcy filing is a federal crime and is investigated by the FBI.
That's what I was going to ask you. Even though you said there's no debtor's prison, there's still prison, isn't there? If you lie in a bankruptcy hearing and in your paperwork?
There, you can be charged with perjury. You can be charged with fraud. You can be charged with other federal crimes if you're not completely honest in your filings, in a bankruptcy filing. Okay. And I personally don't know of anybody who's gone to federal prison over it. I don't deal a lot with bankruptcy, but I do know quite a few people and know of quite a few people who have ended up in federal prison for lying on other federal, on taxes and other things like that.
Right.
So it's not something to be taken lightly. And people do get charged. People do get charged. The biggest thing, the biggest penalty for an individual caught lying on their, or maybe one of the biggest penalty for an individual caught lying on their bankruptcy is their bankruptcy then gets dismissed. And they don't.
Oh, and there's no way out. Now you're truly on the hook.
You don't get discharged. And if it's found to be grievous enough, there may be a finding that you can't file a bankruptcy again without a bankruptcy judge reviewing it first and allowing the filing.
I see.
I've seen that happen to individuals where they've, you know.
Okay. For the regular citizen who's overwhelmed with debt and feels that bankruptcy is the only way out, do they have to hire a bankruptcy attorney? I know it's always best to hire an attorney when you're dealing with big things. But what if they don't have money? How does a bankruptcy attorney work with somebody who needs to file bankruptcy?
I have heard bankruptcy attorneys say, you know, don't don't worry where the money's coming from. You're going to stop paying your bills so you can pay me. And I've never agreed with that. What I would advise somebody is either find an attorney that will allow you to make payments, reasonable payments, and bankruptcy court must approve those payments. Part of a bankruptcy filing asks, are you represented by an attorney and how much are they charging you? At least in East, up here in Sacramento, the bankruptcy court asks that question. I haven't dealt in other bankruptcy courts, but I assume it's the same question. The other option is your public law library. I'll just refer to the Sacramento Public Law Library because it's the one I'm most familiar with right now. It has an entire section on bankruptcy. It has a larger section that includes federal lawsuits, federal law, federal actions. So there is a whole bookshelf there that talks about bankruptcy and how to file and how and what needs to be done. Not that I am plugging them, but there are a lot of good self-help books on not just bankruptcy but other legal matters for individuals that are available in law libraries. I mean, Sacramento Law Library has an entire section of self-help books, and the subjects range from how to write your own will to how to get through bankruptcy, and you know, and almost everything in between that you could think of. So I agree with you. It is best to get professional help, to hire an attorney if you have that option. But if you don't, then use there are resources available. And going to, you know, a public law library is a very good first step. And everyone, or almost everyone I've ever dealt with, has a self-help section with books by, you know, written by attorneys, by law firms, by judges, by, you know, legal scholars that can help and be at least a good starting point.
That is excellent information to know that that's available to people. I did an episode earlier this year on financial infidelity. Mm-hmm. I had not heard the term before, but I understood it once it was explained to me that in a relationship, you're in a personal relationship with somebody, and one person just spends a lot of money without explaining, telling. The other person just trusts, okay, everything is fine, not really looking at bank statements and balances and, you know, until the roof starts crashing in. Mm-hmm. And notices start coming to the house. And so, yes, bankruptcy is an option. And I know that this is out of your purview, but I just wanted to approach this for a second and see if you had anything to say about it. When people get into financial trouble, could we assume that there is an emotional attachment to money that may need to be dealt with and sorted out so that once this one bankruptcy or debt consolidation option is taking care of the current debt, that you don't get back into it again? Have you ever dealt with this in conversation or professionally at all?
I have a bit. And let me put this in the, I recognize this in going to bankruptcy court. One of the questions is, the bankruptcy trustee asks the individual filing bankruptcy is, have you ever filed bankruptcy before? And if you did, when, and how, you know, how long ago, and what kind of bankruptcy? And sitting through some of these hearings, there'd be, you know, 10, 15 of them on in the hearing in the same session I was in. And I noticed that majority of the time, there was, out of 10, there was maybe one person who had ever filed a bankruptcy before. And it had usually been years and years and years ago. And just there had been circumstances. I mean, the biggest circumstance I can think of is that the last time I was in bankruptcy court regularly was the recession, 2008 through 2012.
I had a feeling you were going to say that. That was huge for everybody.
I was there a lot. And it wasn't, you know, and so, you know, there were individuals that these were circumstances that had happened to and not individual choices they had made. But I distinctly remember one man there. And the first time, I think the only time I'd heard this, and the, you know, when the trustee said, have you ever filed bankruptcy before? Yes. When? Well, my last one was 7 years ago. Your last one. Have you filed previously? Yes. 14 years ago. The man turned out to be a compulsive gambler. And he was filing, he was in a cycle that every, you know, he would file bank, he had filed bankruptcy and got rid of all of his debt however many years ago and returned to the same behaviors and somehow kept things afloat until he was eligible for bankruptcy again and then refiled again. And you know, bankruptcy, you're only eligible once every 7 or 10 years. There has to be a minimum of 7 years between filings.
Okay, or, good to know.
But he was a man who had found that was part of his
lifestyle. It sounds like it was part of his lifestyle.
It was. It was part of his lifestyle. And like I say, as I listened to him and did a little, you know, asked a few questions. It turned out that the biggest thing was, as I said, was he was a compulsive gambler. Half of the creditors listed on his bankruptcy filing were cash payday loans and Indian casinos.
Okay.
Just quite frankly.
Right.
And so there is an emotional and a psychological element for some people. Some people, I think this man just had a problem that he hadn't addressed, at least not at that time. And so, and I don't think he recognized that he had a problem. And so that, you know, that goes, you know, back to be honest. Be honest with yourself first.
Well, first of all, recognize, yes, in right. being honest, recognize that this is a problematic cycle.
Right.
This isn't normal. This isn't healthy. This doesn't advantage you. You can't grow. You can't build. And when I had these two doctors on, they were family law, marriage and family therapists, but they specialized in financial infidelity and worked with people that had never had the upbringing and the discussion mm-hmm. about finances, because it doesn't happen in everybody's home. I bet it doesn't happen in at least half the homes in this
easily.
Country that there's a discussion about finances. And then you have that gender gap. If there's going to be a discussion, more than likely it might be between father and son, not father and daughter. That was kind of what it was like in our home. But we didn't have a lot of discussion about how to behave financially other than, and this was the one really good thing my dad always said, and my brother did it quite well, always put 10% of your income away. always, mm-hmm. without fail, because this is how you're going to live in the future. You just can't live on the immediacy of the moment. But I do recognize, and I had to deal with this with myself, if I'm going to be completely honest and vulnerable here, is I had to learn how to have fun saving money instead of spending money.
Right.
I never got so bad that I had to declare bankruptcy. But I did understand that I could have been more responsible in how I handled the money that I earned.
Oh, yeah. No. Retail therapy is...
It's not really therapy, right? Not really, long-term therapy.
No. Well, you know, I have a friend who loves to shop, but then also loves to return.
And that was my mother. She loved doing that. I don't know why, but she did. I wonder why.
You know, and I've been told it's so much fun to find that and to acquire it, and then get home and say, but I don't need it. And, you know, my grandmother, who lived to be well into her 90s, was a teenager was a teenager in the Depression.
Right. No, I think you're right. My mom just died last year. She was 97, and she was a teenager in the Depression. And they live differently.
And she, you know, I remember having a conversation with her once. One of my cousins was staying with her, and she'd said to him one day, you know, a berry pie sounds really good. And he says, well, as he grabbed the keys, he says, I'll run get you one from the store. And she says, I said it sounded good. I don't need it. It's not a need. So put your keys away. And that was just it, was that we have a different mentality than that generation grew up with.
Right.
They, you know, they grew up very much with, you know, that sounds good. That'd be nice, but I don't need it. Or, you know, because they grew up in an era when, you know, they could have things sounding good all they wanted, but they weren't there. They couldn't get them.
Right.
You know, with unless you had a berry patch and you can make it yourself.
And quite often they did. My aunt had the best garden ever with the best tasting fruits and vegetables.
Well, yeah, my grandmother for years lived in a house where she had a very nice berry patch out front, and I loved when I would go by and she had made a fresh berry pie.
Yeah.
But you know, at the time that my cousin was living with her, she lived in another house without that berry patch. And she said, you know, it'd be nice, but I don't need it. And, you know, she had learned that from, you know, a very young age, that you can want things, you can think things are nice, but if you don't need them, you know, it goes back to, my other grandmother talked about cardboard in her shoes or newspapers in the soles of her shoes because they weren't worn out. There was a way to be able to make them usable.
They were still salvageable.
Exactly.
And Lyle, as we're coming to the end of this hour, if you can find, and if not, that's okay too, but can you kind of give people an idea of how they should break down and portion out what they make each month percentage-wise so they don't get in financial trouble?
Sure. I'm going to go with your father's. The first thing is pay yourself that a minimum of 10% of what you earn should go into savings for the future. We used to be told, and I know it doesn't go very far with a lot of individuals I've talked with lately, but when I was coming up, I was told 25 to 30% should be the maximum of my income that I'm paying on housing. If you're paying more than 30, I was always told if I was paying more than 30%, then I either needed to change my housing or I needed to find more income. And then, you know, so if you're paying 10% into savings and up to 30% for housing, that means you still have 60% of your net income to live on. And I would venture that for most of us, our utilities are at least another 10% of our net. So now we're down to 50% of what we have. And that 50% needs to be, we need to be, you know, be able to budget that to say, you know, I've got to eat. Doesn't mean I have to eat steak. I don't have to eat steak every night. I can eat ramen every once in a while if necessary. And I hesitate to put a number on what people should or a percentage on what people should use for meals, because it varies on per person. But I will put a number out there, and that is I would suggest that your entertainment should be no more than 10% of your net. And you should look at keeping your debt, whether it's minimum payments or debt payoff, down to no more than 20% of that net.
Okay, that sounds good.
So by that point, you know, you may have, if you can do that, if you can have the self-discipline to do that, you may have another 10 or 15% at the end of the month that you can add to that original 10% you set aside.
And that actually sounds like fun. For the first time ever, it actually really sounds like fun.
Well, let me just...
Because it's freedom, it's security. Oh, it's you can sleep well at night.
I have heard one financial expert say, you know, you shouldn't buy something until you have 6 months of income in your savings account. And she was talking about buying a new car or buying, you know, taking a vacation or doing some of these things. That her philosophy was that you should have 6 months of income put away before, in addition to that 10% a month or of your net, before you start making big purchases.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a young friend who I kind of laugh at her because she and her husband have never bought a new car. They drive nice. They drive used cars, and he loves to work on them, and he does majority of the work on them. But they've also never had a car payment.
Isn't that phenomenal?
In 10 years, they've never had a car payment. And she's now a stay-at-home mom with three little girls. But she has a 401k that is growing every year.
Yeah.
That will support her, you know, something if
for the rest
disaster
of her life.
Happens.
And by the way, I had a client who I divorced, and she was saying that she's never in her life paid one penny of interest on anything. She never bought anything that she couldn't pay off at the end of the month. And that, to me, was one of the most amazing things I'd ever heard. Lyle, we have to go now. We have come to the end of the hour, and I really appreciate it. It went fast. It went really fast. We covered so much, and I am sure this has been helpful to the listeners. If, in fact, people need help with debt consolidation, would they call you, or do you work for the creditors?
Well, I've done both in the past. The best way, though, is to contact Oakview. Contact me through Oakview, which is OVLG.com.
OVLG.com, OakviewLawGroup.com.
Exactly. And they can find us there. And we have a network of attorneys throughout the country that are there to help, as well as our staff.
Thank you. I really appreciate this, Lyle. I really do. And I hope to have you come back sometime. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And thank all of you, of course, for listening each and every week. If you would like to contact me, comments, or suggestions for other shows, you can do so through my website, theamicabledivorceexpert.com, theamicabledivorceexpert.com. And as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.